afternoon, and welcome to We the People Radio. I'm Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
And so between the three of us, well, Bob doesn't race in here. He doesn't race in here on our time. He races in earlier. What time do you race in here, Bob?
Oh, on Sundays, like a quarter to seven.
Oh.
Oh. I didn't know there was a quarter to seven.
Yeah, there's no quarter to seven on my Sunday. But Phil and I usually race in here and meet Bob, who's all organized, got his stuff all situated, and we fly into our chairs.
I've had a five-hour head start on you.
Yeah, you should be pretty well situated by then. Oh, my gosh. Well, we had so much fun last week with William Kay. We thought we would continue on since there were lots of things we didn't actually discuss. And I do want to let you know that there is a really good video that he did. It's 10 minutes. I watched it while I was scurrying on the treadmill. Probably the last scurry that treadmill's going to do.
You broke it.
What's going on? It's at Malfunction Junction. Well, it was going at 20 miles an hour, and I can't really walk that fast. I'm not sure why you have a treadmill that goes 20 miles an hour.
It just needs a little WD-40.
It's like a car.
It fixes everything.
No, it said it was going there. It's kind of like, okay, I can't do that. I could do like 3 miles an hour, walk along, watch a video. I could do that.
Yeah.
So anyway, I just wanted to let you know at wethepeopleradio.us, we've got a great video there that William did about one of the topics we're going to be discussing today. And then we have a good cartoon about the Canadians. Just in case you're not online, and just in case William hasn't seen it yet, it's Barack Obama and Joe Biden sitting in the back of the beast, probably. And Obama says, they're not buying the Russian crap. And then Biden says, let's blame it on the Canadians. I saw that today. I thought it would be appropriate. So the Canadians get a plug, you know.
It's about time we blame
it on the Canadians. So William will be here to represent them. I guess he's up.
Team Canada.
Yeah. Go Canada.
Hey.
I saw that. I was like, well, that's kind of funny. First thing in my inbox for today. Blame it on the Canadians. Oh, my gosh. So, Mr. K, got your latest video up on there.
Yeah, this is something new for me. That's the first time I've actually made a video by myself. I've been doing this sort of just writing for the Internet, and I've decided that I better branch out and get with the program here, get with the 21st century, and start making my own videos. So that was my first attempt at a solo video. The other videos, I actually hired a company to do them, but this is the first time I
bought
my
scenery.
Own camcorder.
You had scenery in the other ones. This one didn't have this one. This one kind of had that insane asylum backdrop.
I'll wear a straitjacket for the next one.
I'm going to tune in. I mean. but I did kind of chuckle. I was like, what happened to the lovely scenery? He's got the insane asylum going on there. Oh, my gosh.
I just saw the blank wall. Maybe I'll do it against the window next time.
The green screen wasn't working.
I'll mix that up.
As long as nobody... I don't know what your neighbors are doing, but, the window could be dicey. You never can tell. Oh, my gosh. So, I don't know where you want to start today.
Well, I really enjoyed that video. I mean, you know, last week we talked about the whole European connection to global warming and the you know, eco-fascism, but the German connection was kind of interesting. I think we ought to maybe start there.
Yeah, since your website is ecofascism.com, I mean, let's go right to the big players in fascism.
Okay.
Or the big player.
Well, always... You know, fascism is a tricky thing. It's certainly getting bounced around a lot these days. When you mention the word big players, what comes to mind, what I was doing in terms of researching for this show is going back and reminding myself who some of the really big players are in the climate campaign, which, of course, is just one part of the environmental movement. And there's a misperception out there that the environmental movement is run by groups like Greenpeace and the Sierra Club and Friends of the Earth, et cetera. And those are big, influential organizations. I'm not denying that. But the overall movement is much, much larger than that. And those groups, they perform a function within the movement of giving it a sense that it's sort of a mass movement, that it's sort of the people rising up. They perform that function within the movement. But there are other organizations that you don't hear much about. One of the things on my website, I got a list of all the various enviro-skeptical groups in the world that I've come across. And I, reading through those websites, you know, very few organizations really understand, even the skeptics and the enviro-critics really understand the organizations that are behind things like the climate change campaign. I was hoping I could just sort of mention a few of those and profile a few of the organizations that are behind it. Okay, well, there's one group, and it's called KFW. And you'd be forgiven for not knowing what that meant. It's a German word, and it means the Bank of Reconstruction. And it was actually set up by the Americans after World War II to help, you know, most of a lot of German houses were destroyed, their factories were destroyed, and this is part of the Marshall Plan to help Germany rebuild, Western Germany rebuild. The Americans set up a bank called the Bank for Reconstruction. And for the first several years of its existence, it was more or less lending out money that was given to it by the American government through the Marshall Plan. But after several years of making those loans, it could sort of stand on its own. It was raising its own revenues. It was getting money back from the loans that it already made. And it morphs into a rather large financial institution. It's still government-owned. They don't have states or provinces in Germany. They've got these lands. And those various provinces of Germany collectively own KFW. And it's a major bank in Germany, but it remains government-owned. And I'll just read a little quote from their existing, their current website right now, that KFW is supporting the energy turnaround, this transition to the renewable energy in Germany. Over the next 5 years, they will be spending 100 billion euros, which is, I don't know what now, like 120, 130 billion U.S. That's their investment into all sorts of renewable energy and green technologies and clean, climate-friendly technologies. So that's one company that's probably right now lending out at sort of zero-interest loans or no-interest loans about $25 billion U.S. a year.
Wow.
That's their commitment to it. And, of course, it's a government-owned entity, but it's deeply invested in this climate transformation or the energy transformation that is going on in Germany. That's one organization. There's another one called Springer Nature, and it is a subsidiary of a German firm called Holzbrink, which is, last week I mentioned there was a company called Bertelsmann that's putting out about half the books in English in the world right now are being published by one German multinational. Springer Nature is a subsidiary of another major German publishing multinational, and this one owns... it's the world's largest publisher of scientific literature and academic literature. It owns Scientific American. It owns Nature magazine. They boast about being the authoritative voice of science and climate around the world. There's about three major European multinationals that are involved in book publishing, and I'm guessing that right now in the United States, over two-thirds of all the books that are being purchased are coming out of these three companies. They have a real lock on that aspect of American culture. And each one of them can be profoundly linked to the climate movement. This Springer Nature, they accumulate all these scientific journals as part of this buying spree they went through. A lot of the money that they got for that came from a fund called the Climate Capital Change Fund. And it's, again, dominated by these wealthy European aristocratic types. And to pull together this sort of pool of scientific journals that they could use to dominate that sector of the industry. But these aren't small outfits. These are Springer, Holzbrink group itself, a multi-billion dollar a year affair. And it's really targeting scientific literature, particularly climate literature. And Scientific American magazine has been, notoriously global warming alarmist from its inception. So, there's quite a host of these sorts of business enterprises out there that, of course, are much larger and much more influential than the sort of environmental activist groups that we think about. I could run through sort of many of these sorts of organizations And when you do that, you start realizing how deeply involved the European economy is with this whole climate change campaign.
You know, we have to take a really quick break, but when we come back, you should, it would be great if you kind of lined out the European connection again for maybe people who didn't hear last week.
Okay.
Because that was really interesting. It was just a way of looking at it that we completely had.
Well, I hadn't heard that before either.
Yeah, just
it
hadn't
made total sense.
Thought about it, but it made a lot of sense.
Okay, yeah, good idea, because those tuning in for the first time are sort of coming in halfway through the show. They wouldn't, I'll back it up and take another run at that.
Okay.
All right, we'll be back.
Okay.
You are listening to We the People Radio. You can join us at wethepeopleradio.us for all the information about our guests, links to websites, and all previous shows for a bunch of years. We are sponsored this hour by Powerhouse Solar. It was founded in 2003 by Bruce and Susan Blake, grown into the North State's premier solar company. Welcome back. You're listening to We the People Radio. We're here with William Kay, and we are discussing the politics of climate change. You know, we could fight about the science all day long, but the politics are a lot more interesting. All right. Hit it, William, with the backstory.
Okay. I think we have to bring our listeners up to speed. Some of them might not have been tuned in last week. To understand the whole global warming campaign, one has to go back to the 1970s during the OPEC crisis and have to keep in mind that the countries of Western Europe, Germany, France, Denmark, Italy, etc., they have no oil, they have no natural gas. Germany's got a little bit of coal, but it's not very competitive. Basically, these are countries, this is an area of the world that is denuded of sort of natural fossil fuel endowment. So as oil became more expensive due to OPEC, those countries in the 1970s collectively resolved that they were going to transition away from the fossil fuel economy and towards the renewable energy, clean, green economy. Now, this program started for several years before they rebranded it as the climate change campaign. They were already well underway to transitioning to the renewable energy economy when they got the brainwave to turn it into a global endeavor. The thinking in Germany and these other countries is that it's not just enough for Europe to transition away from the fossil fuel economy. If they can get the world to transition away from that, and if they are the early adapters and have the technologies manufactured locally to do things like biofuels, wind turbines, what have you, then it'll be a win-win situation. They will no longer have to import all these fossil fuels, and on the other hand, they'll get to export a lot of renewable energy technology. So this was a strategy that was developed in Europe starting in the 1970s, converted to the climate change campaign in the 1980s, and they proceed with that.
So it was all based basically on the fact that they didn't have the natural resources, and so by switching everybody else over to renewables, they would be on an even playing field with the rest of the world.
That's largely it. Like right now, the EU is importing around $500 billion a year in fossil fuels from Russia, OPEC, what have you. So it's a huge drain. Plus, as you mentioned, there's this other factor of their industries are not competitive because energy costs so much more in Europe than other places. They are at a real disadvantage compared to the United States. If it gets really competitive, You know, the countries that have the cheapest energy are the ones that are going to thrive and succeed. There's other factors involved there. But the real master plan was to convert the whole world to renewable energy and have them buy wind turbines and biofuel digesters and hybrid motor vehicles from Europe, because Europe was going to be the place that it was going to make the transition first, and their companies would be in on the ground floor of this. That's why I was bringing up things like KfW, that German bank. The first 15,000 wind turbines in Germany that were built for commercial purposes were all financed by basically zero interest loans from that one bank.
Yeah.
And that's the German government driving that. A lot of European countries have that base built into their economy. And that's when we, you know, I really enjoyed reading how they, Donald Trump's new climate page or new energy first page on his website that they put up during his inaugural event. The White House changed the website from Obama's energy plan to Trump's. But if you look at it, you know, it's all about, American energy independence. Well, that's what Europe wants. The big difference is that America has enormous amounts of fossil fuels.
Correct.
So American energy independence means really developing their own natural gas deposits, developing shale oil, you know, unleashing the coal mining industry again. That's not an option available to Europe.
So they're just making Europe's problem America's problem.
Bingo.
Yes.
Bingo.
Yep.
And, you know, the way they do that is, you know, well, another thing that happened that unbeknownst to the citizens of Gotham was in the 1980s, when this campaign started, there was a concerted effort on the part of several European multinationals to accumulate cultural assets in America surreptitiously. That is when Bertelsmann went in and started buying up American book publishing companies. They now own 250 of them. Holtsprink was doing the same thing. A group from France was doing the same thing. There's another business in France called Vivendi. They're producing now 50% of all new music sales in the United States are owned by this Vivendi. And these companies all do the same thing. There's an illusion of hundreds of independent book publishers and hundreds of independent music producers. But, you know, go to their websites and they just give you this long list of all the, independent record producers and book publishers that they own. So part of this campaign, like owning things like Scientific American Magazine and Nature American Magazine and, you know, all these academic journals that they have accumulated, have had a profound influence on public perceptions of how serious this climate problem is. But the two things had to happen in conjunction. You know, the movement to, it's an economic warfare campaign against American energy infrastructure. Left to the market devices, America would never have left coal. 70% of American electricity would probably be coming from coal. But the war on coal, had a devastating effect on the American economy. Simply would not have happened without this whole climate change campaign. So it was, you know, a big part of this campaign was this move to acquire key aspects of American culture, particularly book publishing, etc. They have quite a stake in this. Like a book publishing and academic journal publishing in America is dominated by several companies from Europe, headquartered in Europe.
Well, their other big push is to get rid of hydroelectric. I mean, absolutely the cheapest, cleanest form of power. And the environmental, you know, I'm use that term really broadly, but the environmental focus is to get rid of all hydroelectric dams in general.
Yes.
Ostensibly for the fish, of course.
They like sort of these micro hydro ones that are rather useless. Once again, Europe has got a problem that North America doesn't have. It isn't as though you could put a massive dam on the Rhine or a lot of the major European rivers without flooding entire cities. They don't have the vast open spaces that North America does. We could, if we wanted to, build large dams. They're planning one in northern British Columbia. It's not going to dislocate a single person. So in a densely populated place like Western Europe, once again, they're at a disadvantage. They could put in these little micro hydro dams here and there, but the idea of blocking a whole river and creating a huge reservoir of water is not an option available to them. Well, yeah, there's a whole other aspect to this. I mean, the campaign against hydro dams in the United States, it predates the climate change campaign by a long shot. One of the earliest American environmental movement campaigns was against the Hetch Hetchy Dam in California. So they've been attacking hydroelectricity for a long time. Like in Europe, it goes back almost a century. These are people who do not believe in unrestricted economic growth. They want very much controlled growth. They're not so interested in the broader masses having consumer items or electricity and these sorts of things. They're quite hostile to that. They want very restricted, slow growth, etc. So you have to separate out some of the environmental campaigns from some of the other ones. A lot of the hydro dam people around the world, the ones who are promoting it, keep saying, well, this is climate friendly. There's no CO2 here. But this is something, there hasn't been, I think, a really major hydroelectric dam built in the United States now for 40 years.
Well, knowing the European situation, as far as energy and Trump's energy policy, what do you think that's going to do to European relations if we start moving towards energy independence and moving away from their grand plan? Do you think it's even possible?
They are going to resist it. It's going to be extremely unpopular in Europe. They have bet the farm on the world going climate-friendly green. So this is going to really strain and sabotage American-European relations, probably irreparably. People underestimate how deeply invested the Europeans are in this transition to the renewable energy economy. There's an interesting website. It's called the Asset Owner Disclosure Project, and they rate 500 global financial enterprises on how climate serious they are and how much of their clients' money they have sunk into renewable energy of all different types. And, number four on that list is the Dutch or the Netherlands public pension fund. One in six people in the Netherlands have their pensions locked into this giant state fund, over $400 billion in assets. And it is number four on the list of climate-serious financial organizations. And it has already invested scores of billions of dollars in green companies and companies that are involved in the climate industrial complex. Every teacher in Holland, that's their pension fund. Every professor in Holland, that's their pension fund. So it isn't as though that Europe can say, oh, well, to hell with this whole climate thing. Let's go back and just, buying fossil fuels from around the world. Let's give up on this. They are so committed to this. They are so institutionally committed to this.
And what was that thing called again?
They're going to have a very difficult time.
Well, what was that called again? The Asset Owner what?
The Asset Owner Disclosure Project. And it lists all the – I'll tell you who figures very high on the list, that CalPERS, the California Public
I was just going to say California.
Big surprise. Uh-huh. Another good
decision. They're number nine on the list.
Sure.
So they have also sunk a huge amount of their, their people's money in the California Public Employees Retirement System.
So
they are number nine on the list of the most, sort of climate serious financial companies in the world. It's companies like that that are going to take a massive hit. Like if Trump succeeds, that's going to mean an end to all these subsidies to ethanol and wind power and all this sort of stuff. A lot of those companies are hanging on to assets. They're going to be pretty much worthless.
We need to take a break, we come back, let's stay on this topic because I'm kind of curious what Europe's situation is if they have to go this road on their own. Can they sustain
can they do it?
So we'll hit that when we come back.
Cool. All right. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We only take the breaks so we can see what music Bob has for us. Otherwise, there's no incentive. Thanks, Bob. All right, William, what do you think? Can the Europeans handle renewable energy? Can they be in their own little renewable energy bubble?
Alone? Well, the fancy word is autarky, which means sort of an economic strategy where you import and export nothing. You are entirely self-sufficient. There is probably a faction of the European environmental movement, like the green parties themselves, that would be okay with that. It would be an economic disaster, but they could probably survive. They go ahead with this transformation. The goal is by 2040, they have eliminated, this is the current goal, they eliminate the internal combustion engine by 2040. Every vehicle in Europe is electric, and this is almost entirely driven from wind power, solar power, biofuel, methane digesters, waste products, what have you. That sort of system is going to give you very expensive electricity. The products that they would be manufacturing, like the electric vehicles, what have you, right now they're not popular around the world. They're just too expensive. They just don't have the mileage and what have you. That they can't go the distances. These are, so they'd be manufacturing a lot of products that nobody wanted to buy. Their overall manufacturing cost would be a lot higher than their competitors. But they could probably survive. They would slowly and surely become like second world status countries. The rest of the world would leave them behind. But there is certainly a faction within the European environmental movement that they're okay with that. These are neo-feudalists, they were fundamentally hostile to the Industrial Revolution from the beginning. If they went back to a society that was, predominantly rural, and poor, and tourism and things like that were the main sectors of the economy, they could live with that. There's a certain portion of them that could probably, welcome a certain degree of deindustrialization.
Well, so they're certainly okay with the United States going that route right now. I mean, they just assume we fall back in line and let everybody else play catch up while we sit on our hands and pay more for everything. It just seems like that's what they're all right with now.
Oh, yeah. Ideally, they'd want sort of the whole world to make this transition. But if the United States, if Trump is a permanent phenomenon and a permanent redirection of the American economy, Europe would be really left behind. It would become a real sort of industrial backwater, like a second world country. It would end up, sort of in that sort of situation. So they could probably do it. They probably wouldn't starve to death, but they would be in a period of sort of relative decline with the rest of the world. There's a certain aspect of their public that could probably okay with that. That is not the plan. The plan is to, pressure the entire world to go along with this agenda, and the whole world is supposed to transition away from fossil fuels. If you believe their climate rhetoric, that we're catastrophically destroying the Earth's atmosphere, which is, of course, this big lie that they've ginned up to rationalize their own self-serving energy policies.
Well, don't you think Don't you think we've kind of been in a little bit of a state of decline trying to follow the whole green energy idea in the last, 8 years? I mean, I think that's been a big gripe with people is going down this road is just costing so much money and we're getting very little
in return. The Solyndra things and all that kind of stuff that have just been hugely
there's
expensive.
Been one boondoggle after that's all money that because keep taking the money they've poured into wind turbines and ethanol things like that. If that went into building coal-fired power plants, you'd have free electricity in America.
Well, if it, half of it went into just rebuilding our infrastructure, we'd have jobs. I mean, they've wasted so much.
It's a sinkhole. I mean, you're suppressing one of your primary assets in America is the fact that America is this, you know, natural energy superpower.
No, we're a resource giant.
Coal,
yeah,
oil, uranium, it's got it all. There's absolutely no reason why America would go along with this program unless they were being manipulated by foreign powers. They do. They're strong allies within America. They have the coastal elites, you know, San Diego to Sacramento and you know, Boston down to Baltimore. The sort of the elites from those small slivers of America are very much on board with this agenda. But in general, this is not a made-in-America energy policy at all.
No, and it doesn't
fit.
You
don't need this. It's holding you back big time.
Yeah, it just doesn't fit over here. We I think as Americans have a real problem turning our back on all our vast natural resources so that we can pursue a energy plan that just costs nothing but money and truly isn't proven yet.
Well, you have all sorts of things. You know, you look into the you look out a little farther into what's surrounding all of it. You know, what other things are happening at the same time, and you look at things like our forest policy. You know, how do we treat our vast amount of forests on the West Coast? Now, we used to harvest timber and, you know, keep the forest from, you know, burning up every year.
Replanting. I mean, it was a crop and we took good care of it.
Sure. And the Forest Service funded itself that way. That mm-hmm. was part of how they got their money to maintain the national forest. That was part of taking care of the people's land. And now it's, you know, it's just one lawsuit after the next by the environmental groups. But I'll tell you what, removing the Equal Access to Justice Act would put the skids on that in, I mean, 5 seconds.
Now they're gonna have to pay for their own lawsuits. The government isn't gonna.
They don't get paid to sue.
Yeah, give them money to sue us.
Right. So then we'd get some honest lawsuit. You know, I mean, I'm air quoting that. Some honest lawsuits, not just the kind, that where they sue so they can make money, because they do. They'll file just the most ludicrous things, but they get paid for it, so they do it.
Yeah, there's I've written quite a few articles about that. It's been quite a cash cow for the green groups. Yeah, and there's, I forget the name they use for it, these sort of really phony lawsuits where a federal government agency will basically solicit some green group to sue them. And then they settle out of court, and that court order becomes an excuse to expand the permit of that federal agency. There's been scores of those. And because you're settling out of court, you can sort of add whatever conditions you want to that agreement. And usually they add conditions to the effect that the plaintiff's legal costs will be covered. So
they're always covered. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it never costs them any money to do that. That's always part of the settlement. So we end up paying for it on both sides every time.
Oh, everything you can say about America, it goes, you know, tenfold for Canada, because we've got nothing but natural resources up here.
Oh, sure.
But it's a similar sort of strategy. And if you look back to sort of the European, North American competition, if you go, let's go way back. Let's go back to after the Civil War. You know, America built 3 transcontinental railways and Canada built 1. And those railways were financed with land grants. The deal was they sort of created a checkerboard pattern on either side of the railway, usually, you know, 10, 20 miles, and every dark-colored square would be given to the railway company if they built the railway, and the other squares would remain public property. But it was these huge land grants to the railway companies, which were a great idea. That was how that's how the West was won, and it's how those railways were built. The railways, and then the government, went to Europe, because now we had the railways, we needed to get farmers and people out here, and they solicited to people in Europe. This was from the sort of 1860 to 1880s era. And several hundred thousand European farmers came over.
Yeah, settle the West.
Yes, and this, you know, it was designed by Abraham Lincoln. You got 160 acres free land, no money down. It was a win-win situation. You had these sort of desperately poor farmers across Western Europe. But then, of course, the aristocrats of Europe, they didn't like this. But to them, this was the apocalypse. They were the whole towns in Italy and Germany just completely depopulated. I mean, the offer of free land, they were out of there. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the princes and what have you were thinking, well, where's the love, guys? I mean, you know, you've been our sort of serfs for all these centuries, and now you get an opportunity for free land, and you all take off, which they did.
And you all take
but
off.
But keep in mind, west of Chicago, half the land is still owned by the federal government. I mean, this process of really throwing the land open, more or less freely, came to a screeching halt with Teddy Roosevelt.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And he starts setting aside all this and blocking this, and there's a whole bunch of complete phoniness in his propaganda. But so before that, with the Puritans, you know, you got off the boat, they were doing the same thing, 160 acres free land, they give you a Bible, a farm, and, you know, have at it. And there was a long period in American history and in Canadian history, if you could go out in the bush and create a farm, you were doing God's work. You're doing a good thing. And they would facilitate that. And if you could turn a patch of bush into a farm, you owned it. They would give you the title to it. You earned it. That's how America was founded, on those principles, that the public domain, if you could go out there and start a mine or, you know, get a logging camp going, you could keep the money. And then as urbanization developed around New York, on the website, I give the history of some of the major American parks. The most important one is the Adirondack Park in New York State. That was the first one. At this time, sort of New York, New Jersey were sort of built up urban areas. This is in the 1870s, 1880s. Land was getting very expensive there, and there was a land rush moving into upstate New York. And of course, the wealthy burghers of New York and what have you, including the Roosevelt family, who've been in this business for a very long time, they wanted to put a stop on that. So they declared the Adirondacks into this park. They had to remove about 10,000 people from the park. In 1905, William Rockefeller bought a whole town in the Adirondacks, burned every house down, and planted trees all over where those houses were, and he was given a full-page blow-up on the cover of the Collier's magazine of William Rockefeller, Defender of the Wilderness. But the idea that if you just let people move into the wilderness like that, you're really going to depress land prices in the urban areas. And it's a process whereby the Europeans and the coastal elites, again, started to keep the land off limit to the people. They wanted to, what had been part of the American tradition for a long time had to be brought to an end. Otherwise, people were just going to keep migrating to wherever the land was the cheapest.
And
that
succeed.
Process is still very much with us.
Well, I'm not even going to get into the monument thing. We need to take a really quick break, and we'll be right back with our guest, William Kay. You're listening to We the People Radio. Thank you to our sponsor, Powerhouse Solar. And they're not just doing it to be fly-by-night solar guys. They're actually doing it to help you lower your power cost if you'd like to. We'll be right back. Sometimes they can't see the forest for the trees. That's actually a very telling song on every level for this particular program. So, William, next hour...
May need to let the music keep playing because we seem to have lost William, but I'll get him back right away.
Oh, we
hopefully.
Did?
Yes.
Oh, Gosh, we lost William. Now we're stuck with Linda Ronstadt. Bummer.
Well, isn't it interesting, though, that the European energy crisis or their inability to be
energy sufficient, self-sufficient.
Yeah, with fossil fuels is now our problem. And we have to be fair and deal with it and deal with them fairly because, you know, let's not use our resources or that won't be fair to Europe.
Right. Well, that's why we can't count Shasta Dam as a renewable power up here in Northern California.
Excuse the numbers.
Right, because they don't have a big dam in Southern California with hydropower. So we can't count that in our renewable portfolio. So we have to contrive all these other things.
Yeah, put up all the windmills up at Bernie and, you know.
Punish the guys in the north again.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just nuts.
He's back.
Yeah. Well, we were almost forced to continue playing a Linda Ronstadt song. That wasn't good. Hey, the book you were talking about,
Black Earth.
Yeah.
Yes.
I think we need to go into some of that next hour. You want to give people a sneak preview in case the news distracts them and they don't come back?
Sure. Do you want me to do that now?
Yeah.
Yeah, just a little preview and then we'll get into it.
Obligated to. If you notice on my website, on the right-hand column, there is now a list of 40 book condensations that I have done. And I feel obligated to condense any book that deals with the connection between German fascism and environmentalism. And that particular book, I had heard through the grapevine, talked about it. So I read it, but it was actually quite a treasure because it revealed a lot more than just the sort of the Nazi environmental connection. I knew nothing of this Professor Snyder until I read the book, and then I read a lot of his other writings and took a look at sort of the groups that he was involved with. He's very much involved in this high-level Viennese propaganda outlet called the Institute of Human Sciences, but the book itself was published simultaneously in 22 languages. It was, thanks to the Bertelsmann Media Echo Chamber, it became a bestseller in 4 different European countries. It had a profound propaganda effect in Europe last year. And it gives a lot of insights into what the thinking is among Central European elites right now. This was a book about the Holocaust, but it spends more time talking about climate change than Auschwitz. And it reveals a lot about what these people are up to.
Well, that's where 98% of the climate scientists came from, was these books.
Well, that part of it is kind of creepy and crazy.
Mm-hmm.
How was it received, I guess, in North America?
Well, he's not very young. He had a previous book called Bloodlands, which was a similar topic. You know, he teaches at Yale sometimes, at Harvard sometimes. He's sort of a big shot over here, but he's really quite a celebrity over there. Mm-hmm. Very few people sort of read about it, that book here. Even though he's an American, he's a far bigger deal in Europe than he is here. The book was reviewed here. Some people sort of hit the nail on the head. It's sort of a hodgepodge of political views in the book. Reading over the acknowledgments, there were over 40 different academics involved in writing it. It was a really collective project. It's a real political thing. But here's someone, his own private writings, you know, extremely anti-Trump. I get the impression that he's a bit of a poseur. Like some of the things that he says would indicate that he really doesn't know his own field of expertise as well as he comes off. And this is a guy with a PhD in history from Oxford.
Interesting.
But he's not a big deal over here, but he's a huge deal over there.
Wow, that's kind of creepy. And the premise of the book is that, well, you give it. I'm attaching your review on the site for people if they want it, just so they don't have to remember all this stuff. But, you know, give them a little bit of it since you did like a 10-minute video and we have posted that, but...
Well, it's like I say, it's a bit of a hodgepodge. I'd say about a fifth of the book is taken up with personal anecdotal stories about how individual persons from Poland or Lithuania helped individual Jews escape persecution. He's trying to sweep a lot of stuff under the carpet. The reality was it wasn't just the Germans doing all the killing. There were a lot of groups from the Baltic states, particularly Lithuania and Poland, who were up to their elbows in the Jewish Holocaust. And he's sort of erasing that from history. And like as I mentioned, on 35 occasions, he does admit that there was this close connection between ecology and Hitler's thinking. Hitler was indubitably this raving environmentalist. It's surprising that someone like Schneider, who has got a PhD from Oxford in history and who specialized in this precise epoch of history, wouldn't know anything about that until 2010.
That was interesting.
Yeah, and believe me, at that point, I mean, there's books published by, you know, Yale and Cambridge, you know, exclusively focused on this topic. I've condensed every one of those books on the website. And some of these books came out in, you know, the 80s and 90s, you know, biographical accounts of some of the leading ecologists in the Third Reich. So it's just inexcusable that Snyder would never have heard of this. But they give it the sort of weird spin. They make it as though that Hitler was the only ecologist on Europe, and that his ecology is what led him sort of astray. It turned him into this biological racist.
Right.
And all of the other fascist dictators in Europe, they weren't sort of infected by this weird social Darwinism, and hence they really weren't so bad.
And history's already been written, so we're going to come back with more of that. We're chatting with William Kay this morning. His website is ecofascism.com. You can find all of that on our site, wethepeopleradio.us. And thanks again to Powerhouse Solar.